This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, November 15th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
It happened more than once from more than one person.
Did you report it at all?
I did not.
Sure, why?
I did report it even when I was a legislator, and the Speaker of the House asked me if I brought my knee pads to work when I asked if you could help me get my bill out of committee.
That's Missouri Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill there, speaking to the Washington Examiner on Tuesday, talking about being sexually harassed as an intern on Capitol Hill and also as a state legislator in Missouri, and then making the same choice so many women have faced at work to report sexual harassment or not.
Felt like I had to choose between my career and coming forward.
And that's a choice that so many Americans who aren't senators, especially women, know all too well.
I have been sexually harassed by my boss.
And I have never reported sexual harassment in my workplace.
She was too concerned for her job to file a complaint on her own.
No, I never did report it. I
chose not to report it so that I could continue my career.
I did not report. I could see that this would take a huge toll on my life and certainly on my career.
Those are your voices on the silence that can come after sexual harassment or sexual assault in the workplace. We'll have more on that in a moment, but we've been asking this question, and not just to Takeaway listeners. A new Takeaway Harris poll surveying more than 2,000 people finds that 62% of Americans now say they would feel more comfortable speaking out and challenging an abuser thanks to recent high-profile exposures of sexual harassment and abuse. Now, that sounds like good news, but of that group that I just mentioned, that 62%, only about 1 in 5 say a reason they'd feel more comfortable coming forward is that they believe their company would listen and be supportive. In other words, many, many people don't feel like their company, their employer, or their HR department has their back when it comes to harassment or assault.
My name is Judy in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and I have reported sexual harassment and assault at the workplace through the military. It was active duty military, and I reported my harassment of my superior to me to the sexual harassment, the EO officer, and she told me that, yes, I could report it, and yes, I could get him discharged from the military, but that it would cost me my career. I would never get promoted. I would be known as a rat or a whistleblower or whatever.
My name's Rose. I'm calling from New Jersey. A few weeks ago, right after the Harvey Weinstein allegations came out, I reported sexual harassment at my workplace. I was told that I had to put my statement in writing, but I was not informed of what they would do with that statement, although it was implied that the other party would be brought into a meeting with me to, quote, give his side of the story. Basically, they scared me so much that I ended up writing a written statement that redacted my original statement because I was scared of what would happen to me if I went forward with it.
Maya Rigou is here. She's Director of Workplace Equality and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. Maya, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
You heard all of those voices from our listeners, some of whom wanted to report their harassment, some of whom never considered it because of intimidation. Even a U.S. senator who said that in two different venues, she never reported harassment. All of these statements must sound awfully familiar to you.
Absolutely. You know, these experiences are all too common. At the National Women's Law Center, we hear from survivors from workplaces across the country. And about a month ago, we launched the first national legal network for gender equity to help people facing sex discrimination and harassment at work and in schools. And since the launch, which was around the time that the Weinstein allegations were reported, our intakes have doubled and our sexual harassment intakes have increased by 5 times. So, for too many years, countless women and many men have been suffering in silence. And it's because the risk of coming forward is too high. There's too little information out there about people's rights and what the process is like. And as your poll showed, there's no trust in the systems in workplaces, in schools, in the military that we're supposed to respond and to help them.
So Maya, let's start with some basics here then. When we talk about sexual harassment or assault in the workplace, what does that actually mean? I know we're talking about a broad range of behaviors, but what are some of the most common forms that can take place at work?
Right. So sexual harassment is unwelcome behavior that happens to you in the school, in the workplace, because of your sex. So it can mean something like unwelcome sexual advances. So your supervisor says to you, if you want to keep your job, you have to have sex with me. Or it can be a series of comments or conduct that creates an intimidating, hostile, or offensive work environment. So sexual comments by supervisors or coworkers about your body, about your sex life, obscene pictures. But sexual harassment doesn't just have to be sexual in nature, right? It can be based on your sex or your gender. So for example, women who work in male-dominated fields like construction face incredibly high rates of discrimination and hostility and intimidation, denigrating comments about women. And a lot of men face the same type of hostility, you know, having other men question their sexual orientation and call them degrading names.
Well, Maya, we want to focus on the issue of reporting harassment when it happens. And you heard the results of our Takeaway Harris poll there. I want to play for you some of the experiences of some of our listeners in this area. Listen.
Hi, my name is Julie Bailey. I'm calling from New York City. And I have never reported sexual harassment in my workplace. I was afraid of the backlash of not just being a woman, but a woman of color. So you just put your head down and try to deflect and ignore and keep it moving. It may be cowardly as a position, but it's survival.
Maya, that's Julie saying that fear of retaliation requires a survival instinct. Is that justified? Does retaliation happen a lot?
Yeah, and you know, retaliation is against the law, but unfortunately, it's very common in these situations, which is why so many people choose not to come forward. It is a huge risk and a huge gamble. People are putting their careers, not just their current jobs, on the line. And people who do come forward are often labeled liars and troublemakers, which are labels that can haunt them throughout their careers and essentially get them blackballed in their industry.
So in a big or a medium-sized company that does have an HR department, even if there's a stated policy, look, that's not going to convince some employees, many women, that it's okay to accuse somebody else in their workplace of sexual harassment. How do you recommend victims think this through and actually start the motions of reporting it?
Sure. So this is a really difficult issue. Everyone's experience is a little different, and it's a very personal decision as to whether to come forward and report or to stay silent. And everyone has to make the decision that's right for them. So here are a few questions for people to ask themselves to help them think through this process. First would be to figure out what is it that you ultimately want. If you came forward and reported, what is the outcome you would like to see? Is it that you just want the harassment to stop, which is the case with most people? If you do decide to go forward with an HR complaint, then it's important to know what is the company's policy and what is their procedure, knowing that many times what's expected is actually not what ends up happening. Another thing is to first talk through the situation and your options with people you trust, family, friends, trusted coworkers, people in your network. And you know, sometimes when you talk to other coworkers, you might find that you're not the only one this has happened to. And there are other people who have been keeping silent as well out of fear. And it can be very empowering to know that you're not alone and you're not making this up. Another really important piece of advice is to document everything. Whenever there is a comment or conduct or you observe something, to write it down and keep really detailed notes. Keep any emails, text messages, social media posts, all of which will be really helpful evidence if you decide to come forward at some point.
Well, Maya, one of the things that we're learning, though, is that all of these decisions can get even more complicated for people who work in very small workplaces.
Hi, I'm calling anonymously. I have been sexually harassed by my boss, but I don't have an HR department to report it to because we are a very small company and I work hourly with no benefits and need my job. And the person who is harassing me is my HR.
So there's a case, Maya, of a woman who doesn't feel like she has any place to go. The harasser can't work somewhere else because this is a tiny company. He's going to be right there.
Right. And that's a really difficult situation and not an uncommon one. A lot of companies don't have the resources to have an HR department. And in many companies, there is only one person you can report to, which, if it's the harasser, is an incredibly difficult problem. Unfortunately, our federal laws only protect employees who work in workplaces with 15 or more employees. So in very small companies, those employees aren't even protected under our federal laws. However, under state and local laws, people who work in very small companies can be protected, like in New York City, which covers workplaces with 4 or more employees. So one potential avenue in that situation might be to go to the New York City Human Rights Commission or your local or state Fair Employment Commission and make a complaint about what's going on.
Maya, what about the borderline cases, the gray areas in the real world? You know, women often say it can be hard to decide if a particular encounter is harassment in their own minds. They don't like it. At the same time, they may not be sure if it rises to the level of harassment, much less in deciding if it's time to report it. How do you recommend to people thinking through those encounters?
Well, that's why it's so important to document and keep a record of these encounters or these comments, because they can build up and escalate over time. And that's also why it can be really helpful to talk to people, you know, that are in a trusted circle to get their feedback. And you'd be surprised at how many people have probably encountered the same types of behavior in their own workplaces or in their own lives. Now, the law does place victims of sexual harassment and discrimination in a little bit of a difficult position, because on the one hand, as you've pointed out, sometimes it's not entirely clear if something rises to the level of sexual harassment. So if you come forward too early, you're taking a huge risk that the employer will dismiss your complaint or not take you seriously, and you'll be tagged with this reputation. On the other hand, if you don't come forward quickly enough, then down the line, the employer and the courts might say, well, we had a procedure and a policy for reporting. You didn't tell us early enough, and we could have stopped this from becoming something worse. So I think it's really important to gather information, document what happens, and talk to people you trust in terms of making a judgment and a decision.
Maya Ragu, Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. Maya, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick, and more from you now on how you've dealt with sexual harassment or sexual assault at work and whether to report it. Many of you have been reaching out at 8778-MY-TAKE.
I had gotten laid off because the bank moved my position out of the United States to a foreign country. And when there was a farewell party for me, at the end of the evening, this gentleman went to kiss me and stuck his tongue in my mouth. I was horrified and angry and didn't know what to do.
That's Roberta, who called us from Miami.
So what I ended up doing is writing a letter and going to Human Resources and basically said that I am doing this on behalf of all the other women who don't have a voice, all the other women who are afraid to say something because they would lose their jobs. I had already lost my job, so it didn't matter. Nothing was ever done. This man was never reprimanded. The contact that I had, who was a witness, was never contacted, and it was swept under the rug.
Give us your story and your voice. The line is always open here, 8778-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. A breaking story from Southern Africa now, where a military coup appears to be underway in Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe has led Zimbabwe since 1980, and at age 93, he's the world's oldest head of state. But yesterday, the military took Mugabe and his wife into custody and also started taking over government offices. It has all the markings of a coup, but military leaders say this.
To both our people and the world beyond our borders, we wish to make it abundantly clear that this is not a military takeover of government.
That was Major General S.B. Moyo speaking to the people of Zimbabwe in a broadcast on state television earlier today.
what the Zimbabwe Defense Forces is doing is to pacify a degenerating political, social, and economic situation in our country.
Andrew Meldrum is the acting Africa editor for the Associated Press. He's currently in Johannesburg, South Africa, and was a correspondent in Zimbabwe for years. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, as you just heard, Major General S.B. Moyo says this is not a military takeover in Zimbabwe. What actually happened?
Well, the military took over. yesterday, the military armored personnel carriers drove into Harare, took over, first of all, the state broadcaster, then took over other strategic government offices and buildings, including Robert Mugabe's residence. And then they issued a statement on the national broadcaster saying they are in charge, Robert Mugabe is safe, and they are going to pave the way for a transition back to good governance.
And Andrew, do we know where Robert Mugabe is?
We know he's in Harare. We know he's under house arrest held by the army. The army general said we can guarantee his safety. In other words, they have him under lock and key. And South African President Jacob Zuma said this afternoon that he's under house arrest in Harare.
Andrew, Robert Mugabe has been in charge in Zimbabwe since 1980. He's been running that country for a very, very long time. So the question becomes, why now?
Because last week he announced that he fired his vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, and his wife was poised to become the next vice president. And Emmerson Mnangagwa has a lot of support in the army. He came up through the military, and I think the military said, no, we are not going to let our own guy be pushed out, and we don't want the newcomer wife to be taking over.
So do we know what's next in Zimbabwe?
Well, this is the interesting part. The military is taking great pains to say that it is not a military coup. They want to put a veneer on it and say it is a return to democracy. And I believe that we will see Emmerson Mnangagwa, the former vice president, reentering the scene, maybe taking over as a transitional leader and moving the way towards a transitional government that leads to elections. And they want to make it look like it's very democratic. And so it's going to be very interesting to see. It's really, I think, a real trend-setting development for all of Africa.
So we should be on the lookout maybe for transitional government, new elections, as you say. I think we should also be on the lookout for a military that says, not yet, not yet, not ready yet, and all of a sudden you've got military rule.
That is a possibility. We will be monitoring. But they have brought in South Africa and the Southern Africa Regional Bloc, which is of 15 nations. And they are emphasizing that they want things to be democratic. Also, I would like to point out this has been a nearly bloodless transition so far. No shots being fired. Robert Mugabe is, you know, under house arrest, but he hasn't been killed or he hasn't been forced out of the country. So it is unusual by African standards.
Did Robert Mugabe operate with United States support for all those many years that he controlled Zimbabwe? And what is the United States saying now?
Robert Mugabe's been in power for 37 years and counting, and he started off with the support of the U.S. government, but round about the year 2000, 17 years ago, since then, he has been under sanctions from the United States, which started with the seizure of white-owned farms and many human rights abuses against opposition supporters. And so for these many years, he has been under sanctions. He and his wife and nearly 100 of his closest associates have been under sanctions from the United States government.
A relatively bloodless and quiet coup in Zimbabwe, but a coup nonetheless, says Andrew Meldrum, acting Africa editor for the AP. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Let's leave the present behind, shall we, and fast forward 50 years into the future. Welcome to 2067. We've been jumping in time for our 2067 series, asking science fiction writers to give us a glimpse into their versions of the future. Author C.A. Higgins writes about intergalactic travel and sentient spaceships in her Lightless trilogy, but her version of 2067 is all about artificial intelligence in our everyday lives.
Technology, I think, develops according to what's most convenient is a good way to predict it, and AI is actually very convenient. What would make AI more convenient for people is if you can communicate with it more like a person. Which is not to say that I think we're going to have Terminators or anything, but if you can bring up Siri and have a conversation with it.
How are you doing today?
Then that is very convenient.
Really appreciate it.
And so I think that eventually our phones and computers will be talking to us more like people. If we're talking to something that reacts like a person does and we can talk to it like a person does, at what point do we sort of think of it as a person? Even if it's just a machine that we can enter input into. Or do we think of it as like a pet? And what kind of relationship do you develop with a device that can talk to you like a person, that has learned about you and about what you like and about the way you work and has in itself sort of a reflection of you in it? Maybe you could even end up asking it for advice if it learns enough to interact socially, which is something that AI now can't do very well.
It's yeah, like every second.
If you've ever talked to a chatbot or something, it pretty much spits out what other people have said. But eventually maybe it'll sound more natural and also companionable. Because if companionship is something that humans seek, and if you have a device that can tell you all these things, you're going to apply a personality to it all by yourself. If that's a good thing or a bad thing is a difficult thought. I think it's just something that people do. I see it sort of like having a pet, for which our robot overlords will eventually kill me for saying. But, you know, I come home and I see my roommate's cat, and it's great to see that cat. I love that cat, but it's not the same as going out and seeing a person. And so if you have AI that has a certain degree of social intelligence and is able to respond to a person more the way a person would than the way a computer would, there is a certain degree of companionship that will possibly with some people dispel some loneliness, but I don't think it would ever replace human interaction.
Artificial intelligence, not just for repairing machines in 50 years, but maybe even for helping heal our most basic human insecurities. C.A. Higgins is author of the Lightless Trilogy with her version on what the year 2067 might look like. You can check out the whole series on our website at thetakeaway.org/2067. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. There's new attention on the United States military presence in West Africa, and it's not the kind of attention the Pentagon wants. Military investigators are looking into the suspicious death of a Green Beret in Mali. On June 4th of this year, Staff Sergeant Logan Melgar was pronounced dead in what medical examiners ruled a homicide by asphyxiation. The Army didn't release a statement on his death at the time, but then in late October, the New York Times reported that two members of Navy SEAL Team 6 were being investigated for their role in Sergeant Melgar's death. Eric Schmidt is senior correspondent for the New York Times, and he broke the story on the investigation into Sergeant Melgar's death, and he joins me now. Eric, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd.
Eric, Staff Sergeant Melgar died this past June, as I said, and there were a lot of questions around his death. What do we know about how he died and who was there?
Well, almost immediately there were suspicions by Sergeant Melgar's superiors in Germany. The reason why was because the initial report that came from the two Navy SEALs who lived in the same housing that Sergeant Melgar did was that they were in a kind of rough housing, wrestling, if you will. and one of the SEALs had put a chokehold on Sergeant Melgar, who's a Green Beret, and obviously was, and these guys can get kind of aggressive, but they roughhouse around. But in this case, Melgar passes out, and to the horror of the SEALs, according to their initial reports, they tried to revive him, and when that didn't work, they rushed him to a clinic in the capital of Mali, in Bamako, where he was pronounced dead. Now, almost immediately, Melgar's superiors in Germany thought this was kind of fishy, this story. And as they looked into it more, what we've now learned is that there was an ongoing dispute between Melgar and these two Navy SEALs. And it may well have focused on Melgar stumbling across a money-skimming scam that these two SEALs may be involved in. The Navy, we've learned, has been investigating these two guys for basically taking money from a fund that they used to pay informants in their counterterrorism work in this West African country. And investigators who are also obviously now looking at the homicide may well be looking at this as a possible motive for Sergeant Melgar's strangling death.
Eric Schmidt, let's take a step back from the death of Sergeant Melgar for just a moment. A lot of Americans might be surprised to hear that Navy SEALs and commandos are in Mali, in the capital of Bamako. What do we know about their mission there? What are they doing?
Sure. What this was, it's a relatively small presence the military, U.S. military has in Mali, about two dozen or so. Sergeant Melgar was part of a crisis action team, a very small team that reported to the embassy in Bamako, and basically was there to help assess the threats from various Islamic extremist groups, including Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, posed to the embassy, and also assessing or help assess Malian forces that could be made into help forge them into counterterrorism forces. The SEAL Team 6 commandos, these guys were basically helping collect intelligence for French commandos operating in Mali to help them go after these targets. Interesting, this is all happening, of course, against the backdrop of another mission in West Africa, in Niger, which is right next to Mali. And this, of course, is where four American special forces were killed in an ambush in Niger just last month. The soldiers from that unit were also from the 3rd Special Forces Group, which is the same unit that Sergeant Melgar belonged to.
I think it's fair to say, Eric Schmidt, to the extent that the United States is operating in a place like Mali, even if the force is small, a case like this, a case like the death of Staff Sergeant Melgar, has brought a lot of unwanted glare to SEAL Team 6. They would rather operate in the shadows.
Obviously, yeah, and it's just an extraordinary circumstance, of course, when you have two highly trained elite members of this commando force, SEAL Team 6, that are essentially under investigation for the death of yet another U.S. Special Operations Force, a Green Beret in this case. Quite tragic, obviously, but raising all sorts of questions about what their missions were, what kind of oversight they had, both from their military chain of command as well as the U.S. Embassy in Mali.
Eric Schmidt, senior correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks again, Eric.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us here on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is in Myanmar today, addressing the campaign of violence against the Rohingya, the country's Muslim minority. Tillerson met today with both Aung San Suu Kyi, who's Myanmar's civilian leader, and with the head of the Burmese military. Meanwhile, the approximately 13,000 Rohingya living in the United States are watching to see what the United States and other countries will do about ongoing atrocities against the Rohingya. Shokhat Chasoong is executive director of the Rohingya American Society. He fled Burma in 1990 and arrived in the U.S. in 2001. He currently lives in Milwaukee. Shokhat, welcome.
Thank you.
What are you hearing now from people that you know in Rakhine State, where so many of the Rohingya live in Myanmar?
They are in a very serious situation and in a desperate situation that, you know, they are facing on daily basis, the atrocities, persecution, conducting by the security forces of Burma. And, you know, they're burning their houses and villages. That's why, in fear of that, they are trying to cross the Bangladesh. They are in constant fear.
Shokhat, we're hearing that U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has announced an additional $47 million in humanitarian assistance for refugees. Presumably, that's to help refugee efforts in Bangladesh that you mentioned. What's your reaction to that announcement of new aid from the United States?
Yeah, we are very much welcome the announcement of the Rex Tillerson, the State Secretary of the United States of America. But if this kind of aid goes to the Burma in the hands of military government, this would not be helpful because this kind of aid not reaching to the Rohingya people.
Aung San Suu Kyi, known to many in the West because she's the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, has really been viewed in Myanmar as failing to leverage her power to speak about democratic ideals and help protect Rohingya in Myanmar. Why do you think Aung San Suu Kyi has hesitated so much here?
In my opinion, I would say Aung San Suu Kyi is completely denying the suffering of the Rohingya ethnic minority people. Because when she was in detention, when she was a democratic icon before she released from the detention, from the house arrest, she used to speak out about the minority people, including the Rohingya people. She support the Rohingya citizenship rights. Now, when the Aung San Suu Kyi released and come into the power, she completely forget the existence, she completely forget human rights of the Rohingya people. She is defending the military side right now, as far as we see that. And that way, we are very much concerned about the ongoing situation of the Rohingya people, because Aung San Suu Kyi, even though she has the power, she is not speaking out about the suffering of the Rohingya people. Even she tried to prevent, to speak of the name of the Rohingya people, by the term the Rohingya, she is completely denying and, preventing the international community not to use this term. This is the violation of the human rights. She is also practicing the same line of the military general.
Shoka, you fled Myanmar, Burma, in 1990, as I mentioned. How does the situation now compare to the situation for you and for your relatives when you left the country?
It was little bit better than now. When, I left the country in 1990, it was little bit, has the freedom for the people, even though military government, denied the right of the, the citizenship according to the 1982 citizenship law. The Rohingya people at least has something freedom to go from one place to another, to have the access the education, to have access the employment. Now, after 2012, completely blocking, completely restriction over the Rohingya people. They cannot move from one place to another. No, does not have this access to education, does not have the employment access, that they are like staying in Burma in an open prison.
Do you ever think about what your life might be like or what your situation might be now, today, if you'd stayed?
If I stay in Burma, I would be killed. Even maybe I would be burned in the fire, because military government is completely, their intention is to wipe out the people from the land. Almost 55% of the people, they driven out from the land. So I would be killed if I stay today in Burma.
Shokat, you've said that the United States has not done enough to stop these atrocities against the Rohingya in Myanmar. We saw the additional aid announced today. What more do you think the United States and the international community could do to leverage its power over the military government in Myanmar to stop the killing and stop the torture?
I would say the United States government is doing something, but U.S. government need to make a stronger action to stop the violence. Even yesterday, military government, their security forces burning down the Rohingya houses in Butidong. And, a lot of properties, the confiscated by the Rohingya people, even yesterday, according to the reports. So we would like to talk to our government to do a stronger action especially for the Rohingya people, you know, need to do to create safe zone in Arakan, and then also need to make a stronger pressure to the Burmese government to allow the humanitarian assistance to reach to the Rohingya people. I think the American government can do it because American government helped a lot to the Burmese government since Aung San Suu Kyi was in detention. Millions of dollars American government expensed for the Burmese democracy to restore in Burma.
Shokat Chasoong, Executive Director of the Rohingya American Society, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you. Earlier this week, the Food and Drug Administration approved a new version of the antipsychotic medication Abilify. But here's a twist. This pill is digital. It allows a patient or a doctor, up to four other people, to get on a smartphone app and monitor whether that medication has been taken as prescribed. Now, other pharmaceutical companies are rushing to get on the digital pill bandwagon. You probably predicted that. But some ethicists are raising concerns here about potential abuse. And you're concerned, too.
Mark from Salt Lake City. I wouldn't sign up. Insurance will ding us every time. Rates would go up any time I missed. Of course, there's a monetary incentive for doctors and insurance companies to create a marketplace for this information.
There are some concerns that you heard there from Mark in Salt Lake City. Now, some of you aren't alarmed at all and say that a digital pill is just another way to be reminded to take your medicine.
This is Julia from Clayton, California. All I know is that it's great for people who suffer from schizophrenia and who often forget to take their medication. To err is human. I don't think it would work for the elderly who don't have smartphones to remind them. I had two kids in high school and a full-time job and had to move my father in to take care of him. It's a very big job doing medications and doctor's appointments and the bathing and the feeding. I'm very interested to see how this works with the implanted chip.
Emily Largent is Assistant Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Emily, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Well, you heard some of the concerns from our listeners, and we're going to get to a lot of the ethical implications here. But first of all, a digital pill. How does it work?
So as you mentioned, Abilify is an antipsychotic, and it's prescribed to patients for conditions like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and depression. So the digital pill that was just approved is actually the Abilify that patients have already been taking. But in addition, the pill has a small sensor inside that's about the size of a grain of sand. And when the patient swallows it and it gets in contact with their stomach acid, it actually generates an electrical signal. And that signal is detected by a Band-Aid-like patch that's worn on the patient's rib cage. Then the patch sends the date and time to a cell phone app via Bluetooth. So patients can go into their cell phone app, as we do with a lot of things, and they can add information about their mood, activity, the rest they've been getting. And then that information is transmitted to a database that can be accessed by the caregivers, family, friends, as you mentioned, up to four people who the patient gives permission for.
So the extent of the data from the digital part of this digital pill, is it any more than took it or didn't take it?
So that's actually right now it is about the date and time and the amount that's taken, but you could imagine this having a host of additional information over time. So it's not limited. It's just that in this case they're focusing on date and time.
All right. So what are some of the ethical questions as you see it, Emily?
So I think that they come in sort of two flavors. There are the benefits that we can anticipate from this, and that is that about half of patients fail to take medications as that are prescribed. And this, you know, obviously if you don't take a pill, the pill can't do much for you. And so non-adherence has serious consequences for patients, and it also has a lot of social costs associated with it. We would estimate that there's more than $100 billion a year in healthcare spending attributed to patients not taking medications, and at least 100,000 people die preventable deaths because they're not taking their medications. So what we're looking at is that we have these ethical benefits and that we might be able to have greater adherence and address these problems. But on the flip side, we think that there are privacy concerns. So patients who are having pills taken in this way, you know, we're worried about the information being hacked, the worry of our times, particularly because mental illness is stigmatized. We're worried about this particular population of patients being the first group going out. And we really need to think about how clinicians are using the information. One of the callers mentioned that they were worried about insurance companies using it against them, and we really need to know, are we using this information to try to collaboratively problem solve with patients to help improve their adherence? Are we trying to tailor medication regimens for their benefit, or are we going to use it in punitive ways? This leads to a second set of questions about coercion and consent. I don't think these pills are going to be good for everyone. There will be some patients who are vulnerable, and we need to make sure that their employers, insurers, and others who are in positions of power over them don't inappropriately require monitoring that patients might not want.
So it sounds like one of the best uses here may be in a case like schizophrenia, a disease where patients can fundamentally lack insight or the ability to stick to the medication that they need to get better. This could not only remind, but could also alert caregivers whether the medication is being taken in the first place.
Yeah, I think that phone a friend aspect of it could be particularly helpful. There have been some studies done on smart pill bottles, and so these are bottles that communicate with cell phone apps. They might buzz if you miss a dose or send you a text message. And studies have actually found there hasn't those pill bottles by themselves don't do much to increase adherence, that it's actually even better when the bottle notifies a friend who can maybe come in and nudge you to take the medication.
You know, but Emily, you also raised the prospect of a form of coercion here. We say that we value medical privacy in this culture, but even someone who can't or won't make the best decisions for themselves still has a right to make bad decisions. So this monitoring, does it amount to an invasion of privacy or at a minimum a diminution of agency?
I don't think it has to. So there have been some protections that are built into this. The first thing is that this grain of sand-sized sensor is digested by the body and excreted. So people aren't continually having a monitoring device inside of them. The Band-Aid-like patch can be removed, and it has to be replaced at every 7 days. Anyhow, and there are protections in place, too, that patients can go in and they can instantly remove their physicians and their family members from seeing their data if they don't want them to. So patients do still have a fair amount of control. And I think we also need to think that in these situations, patients might have insight in the present and would like to prevent their future selves from making decisions that could harm them.
But look, we heard from a caller in Salt Lake City who had major concerns about insurance companies, and I think he's right. They would love to have as much of this data as possible, even as it gets richer and richer into the future. One important exercise, Emily Largent, here is to take these ethical questions and take the scenario to its logical conclusion. So what is that for you with Abilify, the digital pill, in the future?
So I think that the FDA is already anticipating an extreme uptick in requests for approval of other digital pills, and I think that we're going to have serious conversations about who can see the data, how it's protected. We could, of course, imagine that insurance companies might try to condition coverage on good adherence, but right now the plans are to simply offer them de-identified data so that they can see general trends rather than patient-specific information, and we're going to really need to put protections in place to make sure that people aren't punished for making decisions that maybe make the most sense for them.
A new digital pill approved by the FDA, and now patients, doctors, and ethicists grapple with the questions that follow. Emily Largent, Assistant Professor of Medical Ethics at University of Pennsylvania, thank you.
Thank you.
What do you think?
This is Linda from New Jersey. I would not be interested in taking a digital pill because I believe it's my responsibility to take my medicine if I choose to. And if I choose not to, that's my business, and it's no one else's business. I have no problem with others using the technology if they choose to, however.
My name is Meredith Glenn. I'm from Provo, Utah. I would not choose to take the digital pill. I wouldn't want to put those weird things in my body. And I think if people aren't willing to take responsibility for their own pill taking, they aren't invested in their own health. So why should it be the doctor's responsibility to keep track of whether the patient takes the pill or not?
This is Portia Scott. I'm calling you from Charleston, South Carolina. No, I would not sign up for this type of medication at all. I mean, I enjoyed George Orwell's book, 1984. However, I am not ready to live there yet.
Portia is not ready to live in that place, no matter what the FDA says about a digital pill. Some of you are uncomfortable with the idea. Others think it's a great way to enhance compliance with medication. Keep sending us your thoughts on the digital pill or anything else you hear on The Takeaway. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time. And Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.